Well, hello, everyone out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network podcast, the podcast for people who actually like movies. And tonight we are talking about a very special movie that we all like quite a bit. This movie is actually celebrating a couple of anniversaries. It's the 25th anniversary of the film. And this month, it's actually the 50th anniversary of the historical event, which takes place during the film. We are discussing Apollo 13. This evening, and I'm very excited to do that. My name is Craig. I'll be your host for this evening. I'm joined by the host of Front Row Network's Classics, Mr. Sir Esquire Brandon Davis.
Hello. Hello. Good to be here.
It's nice to have you. It's nice to have you. Have you been having a good time this last couple of weeks? How are you doing? How are you holding up?
Oh, not, you know, as good as one can be in quarantine, I guess. But yeah, plenty of movies to keep me company. This is one of those times where I'm glad I still hoard physical media.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Also joining us this evening is my wife, Anna McFarland. How are you?
Hi, doing well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I mean, you're kind of stuck in the house with me, so I thought it might be makes sense to do a podcast. Actually, it's really cool. One of the really neat things that have come from this situation we're all living in is that the three of us have been going back and watching some movies together. And so what we do is we start them at the same time, and then we're kind of texting. I know that Alamo Drafthouse would hate us, but we are texting during the movie, just saying what our thoughts are. And it's been really, really neat. We took like a whole weekend in Paris where we watched An American in Paris and also Midnight in Paris. And it's just a really neat thing to do. And one of the films that came up, because Anna is very interested in this film, was Apollo 13. And of course, because of the significance this year, we decided what better year than this to tackle it. And so I'll let Anna begin our conversation this evening and talk to me a bit about what this film means to you, and also kind of what your first impressions were, first time you saw it. How did it stick with you?
Yeah, well, it's something I think about every April, just based on the day in history, April 14th, we have Apollo 13 and the day Lincoln was shot, Titanic, and it's just something that I always think about every year, and this year especially. But Apollo 13, I went and saw it when I was 9 years old with my dad when it came out in the theaters, and I was just immediately struck by it. I've always been into space and into astronomy and just learning about different things. I wanted to go to the National Air and Space Museum because of this movie, and I did a book report on Jim Lovell. I mean, I went deep cut. I went to do the planetariums. I just really got involved in space after seeing this movie, and I think it's because of the way that they tell this story is just so engaging, and they do it in such a way that you've learned a whole lot too. And so it's made a big impact on my life, and I always go back to it.
Absolutely. You know, it's one of those films that really opens your mind to space travel. You know, I think when I was growing up, I was so much more into the science fiction side of things because Scott was a huge Star Trek fan. This was about the time I was around 10 years old. Things like The Rocketeer was coming out. You know, there's other movies that really drew my mind to like space and all of that, Star Wars, everything like that. But not necessarily in like real life and experiencing sort of firsthand the way that Ron Howard does this film. You really kind of experience being in that capsule for Apollo 13. And it's just an incredible movie to be able to paint the picture of what it truly was like. And I really appreciated about that film, even from the first time that I saw it. It was just one of those that captured the imagination and really wanted me to look into things like NASA and the space journeys that we've had, the space shuttle at the time. International Space Station was sort of in the news right around the same time that this was coming out, maybe just a little bit later. And so just all those things, this movie was kind of the starting point for that for me. Brandon, how about you? What have you, what drew you to this movie? What are your first impressions of it?
Yeah, what's interesting is, I was never really science was not my thing and sci-fi was not my thing when I was a kid, but I love history. So the historical aspect of this movie is kind of what drew me to the movie. And I don't think I saw it in theaters when it came out. I think it was a couple of years later when it started showing on TV when I caught it. However, looking back now, though, I wish I had the theatrical experience of seeing it on a big screen. You know, we're all wishing we had theatrical experiences right about now. But yeah, I just the historical aspect of it really caught me. And you know, Tom Hanks, he's kind of like our Mr. American nostalgia. Like his whole career has kind of sort of been around, you know, portraying different historical events. But I think more and more what I've learned to appreciate about it is just sort of the meticulous detail that Ron Howard as a director brought to the movie, and how most of the time if someone was to dramatize a historical event like this, you would want to add, you know, like a love story to it, or add, you know, a bunch of other little dramatic pieces surrounding it. But aside from Tom Hanks and his family aspect in this movie, everything is pretty much almost documentary, where, you know, you're just looking at the events and how they happened, and letting just the natural emotions play out. So I think this movie kind of stands out in that way.
A bit different than Pearl Harbor, for instance.
Yes, yes. Thank goodness Michael Bay didn't get a hold of this.
They do such a beautiful job, too, of seeing together the live footage, the real historical footage, with the film. And it's just a beautiful way of mixing the true with the fiction.
I have to just take just a moment here and a little bit of behind the podcast. This is the third time, this is the third night, consecutive night, we have tried to record this episode. And right about this point of the episode, every previous iteration, Brandon turned into a robot, and I could not understand him. And so we may be living on borrowed time here, but I just want to congratulate all of us for advancing past this part of the podcast. We're now going to kind of boldly go into the next portion, and just pray for us, folks, that this podcast, if you look at it now and it's only about 15 minutes long, you know that we finally have just given up this Herculean effort that is Apollo 13. So we really wanted to bring it to you, and we really want to have this discussion. And you know, this is one of those where I love movies that have great ensembles. So it's one of the reasons why, like, when Spotlight won Best Picture, I was really happy about that, because that ensemble is so great. And I think in this film, you really can't necessarily break it down to talking about individual actors, although of course we can and we will, but it's really the full team came to play here, the whole ensemble, of course led by Tom Hanks, but then you have wonderful roles by Ed Harris and Bill Paxton, and you've got Kevin Bacon and Gary Sinise, just these wonderful actors that all come together and really do a great job of bringing the whole film together. And to believe that this was all shot 25 years ago, what's great, Brandon, tying in with what you were saying, the docudrama kind of side of this movie, because they only did it 25 years after the events of Apollo 13, they had a lot of primary source materials they could go to. A lot of these folks were still with us, and they could go and talk to them and see exactly what mission control was like at that time. And I think that only helped that ensemble propel this movie into just the, you know, pardon the pun, the stratosphere when it comes to just the quality of this film. I really enjoyed it overall. But I think we can definitely pinpoint some acting pieces that we want to draw out. And I think that has to start with Tom Hanks. And Brandon, since you started that discussion a bit in your first talk, let's go ahead and continue that with you and talk about Tom Hanks as Jim Lovell in this particular film.
Yeah, and you know, just most recently, just plugging another podcast that we did, Tom Hanks won our greatest movie star bracket, which I was a part of, and he was in the final four along with Jimmy Stewart, someone who I kind of, I always kind of consider him the modern Jimmy Stewart, because they both kind of play these idealistic, all-American figures, and Tom Hanks does for us now what Stewart used to do. And you know, I think about, you know, Jimmy Stewart playing like Charles Lindbergh in The Spirit of St. Louis. Well, that's kind of the equivalent of Hanks playing Jim Lovell here. And there's just such a good, solid unflappable idealism that Tom Hanks brings to the role. And he doesn't do a whole lot of, you know, big dramatic hysterics or something like that. He plays it very, very close to the vest, and he just plays a great leader. And he's someone that if you were to come across in real life, you would just trust with your life. And the leadership qualities that he captures in Jim Lovell, and his, you know, calm during the storm attitude is captured so well here. I think this is one of his sort of underrated performance, probably because he doesn't get like the big, you know, dramatic moments that he does in movies like Philadelphia or Forrest Gump, but it's solid all the way through.
Absolutely. You know, what I like about his portrayal here is that you really feel the anguish that he feels, and sort of the situation that he's put into. At the start of the film, he's not even thinking he's going up for a while, right? So, and then essentially an ear infection leads him to being bumped up to Apollo 13. He has about 6 months to prepare for that. And they kind of take you through that sequence, particularly with Gary Sinise's character. And that's where you really feel bad for Ken, because he's really doing all the testing and then ends up being sidelined. We'll talk about that a little bit later, but there's a lot of human tragedy within this story of a tragic event that happened that ended up all working out for the best. But one of the scenes that really encapsulates Hank's performance for me is when he's looking out the lunar module at the surface of the moon, knowing that this is going to be the last time that he's going to have the opportunity to step on the moon. He's going to be aging out of the space program. You don't know if you're going to be on that rotation again. You don't know, of course, Apollo didn't even last very long after 13. So we haven't sent a man or woman to the moon in a long time. And so you really do get that sense of like, this is something that I've really wanted for my entire adult life, and it's not going to happen, but I have to keep my head in the game. Mm-hmm. I have to get my crew home safe. And not only my crew, but my crew, where one of them is experiencing, you know, a UTI and fever and just having a horrific time, and so it really does take a leader in that instance to be able to look and find the ways to stay calm and be able to get them back to where they need to go. And Tom Hanks portrays that to such a magnificent degree. Like you said, you brought up some of his other characters that he played throughout the 90s, but just a string of movies that you really can't, you can put that up against any actor in history. And Apollo 13 is definitely within that string of movies, with Philadelphia and Forrest Gump and Castaway and all the way up to Captain Phillips and even this year. You know, there's so much that Tom Hanks gives us in this movie. I just love it. Mm-hmm. Anna, what do you think about Tom Hanks?
Yeah, well, thinking about it, I think this is actually the first Tom Hanks movie that I've seen. As a child growing up. And so I think that that's what has led his career for me beyond that is just, this was the starting point for him. And it's just the way that he plays the little things, the subtle things, is so poignant and so well done. It's not the big things you do, it's the small things. And the way that he carries that emotion all the way through is just really impressive. And so I think that really sticks up for him. And, you know, you bring up that good point about things that he missed. And I think that one of the neat takeaways from this with his character especially is that his whole dream and ideology is that he's getting to the moon, and that's his main goal, is I'm going to get to the moon, I'm going to walk on the moon, I'm bringing these moon rocks home for my son. And as they get into this tragedy, he realizes, I think, that that's not what the end game is. The end game is that he wants to be home and be with his family, and he wants everyone to be home with their family. And what a beautiful message, especially in the times that we're living right now. So I think that that's what really struck me this time watching that movie, is that a new realization that he thinks his dream is one thing, and he finds out through this journey that it's really something else. And he was open to that.
Yeah, absolutely. He's joined on the mission by Bill Paxton as Fred Hayes and Kevin Bacon as Jack Swaggart. And of course, Swaggart was not initially supposed to be on the mission, that was supposed to be Ken Maddenly, played by Gary Sinise. So I think we can kind of take these three gentlemen on together here. But Brandon, we'll start with you again. Any of these three performances that you particularly want to note for us?
I've always been a fan of Gary Sinise. I think he's very underrated. And I think that he does a great job as Mattingly in this movie, because he really sort of captures the whole disappointment of not being able to go. And, you know, and there's such a, it's like a punch in the gut, and it's such a, you know, split second decision made, you know, to allow him not to go. And you just feel that. And then, but there's also this great humanity, you know, in him coming back and being part of Mission Control and, you know, being part of the team that helps bring everything home. And so he's able to participate in his own way. I think he also, very similar to Hanks, has sort of this, the sort of all-American idealistic attitude, but there's a little more of a, you know, unlike Hanks, there's a little more of a sadness in his performance here, but he's very much able to combat that toward the end, you know, when he's able to contribute a little bit more. But really, all three of these guys, Sinise, Paxton, and Bacon, I think all three very underrated actors, and they really are great when you give them especially ensemble work to do. And so I think this is a movie where all three of them shine.
Yeah, and I think going off of that, Brandon, I think that we see with Sinise, his character, when he's back at home and he's trying to help those guys, he has the same realization, I think, that Lovell did, just that he's there for a new reason now, and he needs to be there for his guys, because he's the only one. If he wasn't there, he knew exactly what those guys are going through and what they've been through, and he was a part of the team up until the last moment. And so for him to be able to be on the ground was monumental, and being able to help them along. And I think that the way that Gary Sinise plays his character and is able to help that realization is just a really beautiful moment in the film.
You know, a lot of this it could be looked at as serendipitous that things happened the way they did. Lovell's bumped up with the crew and all of that. And one of the things that is an interesting thing to think about is if Ken Mattingly is on Apollo 13 and Jack Swaggart's on the ground, what outcome does that have, you know, does in the historical context? But I just wanted to mention, I love Gary Sinise. I mean, first of all, the charitable work that he's doing right now for veterans is just unmatched by just about any actor in Hollywood. He's just, his organization is doing so much good. I just, you know, we're big Disney fans. He just took basically busloads of Wounded Warriors families to Disney, but also just giving back to the community in such great ways. But talk about a guy that had an incredible 1990s in addition to Tom Hanks. So, of course, he was in Forrest Gump with Tom Hanks in 1994, just before Apollo 13 came out. I actually think my favorite Gary Sinise thing that I've ever seen is the miniseries The Stand. He played the main character, Stu Redman, in that miniseries. Do not watch that miniseries right now, because it's about a virus that takes out the world, and then it's post-apocalyptic. But it is, you know, of course, based on the Stephen King novel, and he is so great as the anchor and the protagonist in that film. And then also in 95, the same year Apollo 13 comes out, he plays Harry Truman in Truman, which is kind of an underrated biopic of the past president. And so just a marvelous actor, extremely versatile in what he does. And I would say that, kind of continuing on with this, the other gentlemen that are also in this discussion, Kevin Bacon and Bill Paxton, they also round out some incredible 90s era actors. I mean, this was really hard-hitting and top-flight talent that they were able to get for Apollo 13. Of course, Ron Howard comes calling, and you probably jump on that opportunity. But let's talk a bit about Bill Paxton, because he's going to be going on to Titanic. So he's going to go from the Earth to the depths of the ocean here in just about a year. But Bill Paxton does such a great job as Fred Hayes, in my mind, of showing you the pain, like the physical pain he's going through. I mean, there are scenes in this movie where your gut is literally like wrenching for this man, because he looks so sick, and you can just tell he is in such a bad way. He's still trying to be there for his other guys, and has really no business being in this lunar capsule at the time. And so it's just a great performance overall. The makeup, in my mind, I kind of noticed that more this time, because I always noticed the production design of like the icicles on the actual capsule that they're in. You can tell that it's getting cold. You can tell all of these horrible things that are going on. But this time I really noticed Paxton's makeup, because man, he looked so gaunt and like just dead in some of these scenes. And he really brought the acting to that too. And I like him even before he leaves the earth and is that cocky individual going up. So just overall great, great acting portrayal by him as well. Anna, I'll go with you next on Bill Paxton. Any comments you'd like to add there?
I think he plays that part really well. I enjoy his. So I'm a big Paxton fan. I'm also a huge Titanic fan. So I'm very familiar. For me, this is his favorite, just because when I'm watching this, I don't see him as an actor. I see him truly as that character. I think he just brings to it what he needed to. I think that you can see the little things that he does very well in this film, and he's coming in, and he has that, the way he portrays somebody who's coming into a new situation and is trying to show that he knows what he's doing, but is also nervous on the inside. I think he gives lots of layers to that, and he does such a nice job of rounding off the crew in this film.
Yeah, and of course, unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago at 61, so a very young age to leave us, but just a mountain of work that he had done, and some amazing, really memorable roles, including Aliens and so many others, to just so many, especially in the 90s. And of course, Twister had come out just about the same time as this. Actually, I'm looking up on IMDb now. Twister comes out, so he goes from a run of...
He's the king of natural disaster in the 90s.
Yes, he's got a run of movies that, you know, he starts kind of in 1994 with True Lies, and then he does Apollo 13, Twister, Titanic, just so many of these huge, Mighty Joe Young. I mean, so many of these huge tentpole movies of the 90s that involved Bill Paxton as well. So Brandon, talk to me about him.
Yeah, he's really the one, I think, that... we as the audience kind of, we love to torture ourselves and put ourselves in other people's shoes. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, this is kind of the nightmare that we as the audience think, oh, what if we were in this situation and this happens to us? But his character really, you know, despite the pain and agony he's going through, he really shows a resilience and really, really doesn't buckle. You know, he stays the course. And you're right about the makeup, but I, you know, this was a movie that wasn't made in HD, so I didn't think they probably didn't think it would be as noticeable now as it is to us 25 years later. But but yeah, just really I think of all the characters, really shows how, you know, despite human frailty, he's still able to beat the odds and, you know, come out of it strong.
Absolutely. So let's round out our discussion with Jack Swaggart and Kevin Bacon. And this will be kind of the mains. And then I do have a couple of others in the ensemble I want to get to as well. And I'll open it up for you guys. But I'll start here with Kevin Bacon's portrayal. You've got someone who comes off as fairly cocky at the beginning and then really brings it. You kind of sense that pressure that he's getting. He's the new guy, you know, he's thrown into this at the very last second. It's 2 days before the launch. He moves up from the backup crew onto the main flight crew, which has to be a whirlwind of emotions anyway. But they make a really big point about him actually connecting. I don't quite understand the logistics of the rocket that they're using, but essentially his major job is going to be to pilot this. And so, it just, you kind of get that sense again of someone that maybe is cockier in real life, but at the same time has to work with this team to succeed. And just great moments throughout with Bacon's portrayal as well. Brandon, any thoughts on Kevin Bacon?
Yeah, I mean, Bacon always has great swagger, and that's what, you know, Ron Howard cast this movie great, because, yeah, Bacon really, he's kind of, you know, plucked out of nowhere, and then, you know, it's sort of like, okay, here's this person you have no emotional connection with, and now you've got to be thrust into this situation where you totally depend on each other. And it's kind of the same way for the audience too. We feel like we've been in training with Hanks and Sinise and Paxton, and now we've got to get used to Kevin Bacon here, and as we go on the mission with them. And but yeah, I love it. He kind of starts out as a little bit of a cardboard cutout character, and then as you move on and you get to go through the little smaller moments with him, more of his dimensions come out. And I think that's by design, but I think he really adds sort of a he's kind of a wrench thrown in along with sort of the coolness of Hanks and Paxton.
Absolutely. And just again, another mainstay of really 80s and 90s for Bacon, especially starting with Footloose. But you know, our guilty pleasures friends would be very remiss if I didn't mention that he was in Tremors in 1990. Then of course, moving into JFK and that wonderful portrayal in A Few Good Men. So of course, Kevin Bacon, this whole ensemble, especially those four men, just really owned this decade moving forward. And I do want to bring up at least two other people in the ensemble, the first being Ed Harris, and then Kathleen Quinlan as well, as Jim Lovell's wife. I'm sorry, I'm not on the IMDb page. I'm missing her first name. Marilyn Lovell, thank you so much. Gosh, that was so male of me, sorry. So I do want to bring up these two in particular. The mission control setup, and Ed Harris, he's very stoic in this role, needs to be very stoic, needs to be very level-headed, very Ed Harris. And I think he fit this role. You know, you mentioned the swagger that Kevin Bacon brings to Jack Swaggart, but definitely the stoicness of Ed Harris really, truly comes through. And you really only get the emotion towards the end, really, when he knows that they're back on the ground or back in the ocean, and that they're safe, then he really can let that out. But love his portrayal in this film.
Ed Harris playing Gene Kranz sticks out in my 9-year-old memory vividly because of how well he played that role. Like, I remember thinking, holy cow, what an incredible person that Gene Kranz was, and how well he played that character, just because of the strength, the vulnerability, and the honesty that he portrays. All a lot of emotions, and he does it so well, and just what an incredible time that must have been for him.
Yeah, absolutely. Brandon?
Yeah, Ed Harris is one of my favorite actors. He and Kathleen Quinlan are the only two people from this movie whose performances were Oscar nominated. And he plays that character so well. And to me, Ed Harris is just kind of this 90s, early 2000s mainstay where, you know, he's always playing the kind of man behind the curtain, to quote Wizard of Oz. He's really kind of, you know, this overseer in a lot of movies. I think of like him in The Truman Show, you know, where he's, you know, the producer of the TV show that's following Jim Carrey around. And he's always plays this calm, cool, and collected guy with that sort of tension bubbling under the surface. And you're right. One of my favorite moments in the movie is when everything's finally over and he's finally able to let that bit of emotion out. It just shows how great of control he has as an actor, but yeah, I mean, this is a guy who really, his job demands that he not be emotional. And so he's going to be by the book as much as he can because he has to. And Ed Harris plays all of that great.
Absolutely. And why don't you speak to us about Marilyn Lovell?
I love her portrayal. She does a beautiful job. And the way that it's written for her is so beautiful as well, because it ties it all together in a nice bow. And you see the way that she and her husband, Jim, go through it together. And the subtleties that happen, like how she loses her wedding ring down the drain. And she has those nightmares that she's having. So she has all these tips that she's trying to brush off. You know, my husband's been in space before, and she's trying to be that strong person for everyone around her.
But you can see through her characterization that inside, she just kind of can feel it. She has an intuition that, you know, something's not right about this one, and I don't know what it is, but I'm going to trust that everything's fine. And I think that she plays that really well, and the way that they have that connection is beautiful. Even when, for me, it really shines through, too, when Tom Hanks is up in space and he puts his thumb out and he's covering the moon, or excuse me, covering the Earth like he covered the moon back at home. I think that's a beautiful moment to show that he's still connected there. And I, to me, it shows that he's still connected to Marilyn and that they had a really beautiful, subtle relationship.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just a wonderful portrayal. And the ring thing actually happened. You know, that's another Ron Howard bringing in some real life. Little dramatized because you never see her get the ring back, and she did get it out of the drain, but she thought that that was a strong, strange omen kind of leading up to the launch. Brandon, any thoughts here?
Yeah, she really plays the whole tension of, you know, she wants to support her husband. She really, you know, wants to, you know, be sort of the perfect space wife. But you know, of course, there's always that lingering fear, you know, is he going to come back? Is he not going to come back? Am I going to be left to raise these two kids? But, you know, I want him to fulfill his dream and his destiny and all of that. And you're kind of, once again, you know, this what this movie does well is put you in that situation. You think of, you know, what you as a human being would be in that situation. And she's very, very just relatable. And I think she and Hanks have really good chemistry. They're not in very many scenes together, but I think in just, you know, the couple of scenes they have together, though, you understand the depth of their relationship and their history.
For sure, for sure. And then honorary mention, of course, you, there's so many people in this ensemble. We could do this all night. But honorary mention to Gene Howard, who played Blanche Lovell, Ron Howard pulling in his mom to play Blanche Lovell. And she does such a great job at the nursing home. And is Jimmy on the TV yet? And just everything about it. I absolutely love it. And I think it's absolutely adorable that Ron Howard put his mom in the movie. So
and his brother Clint is one of the Mission Control guys.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, just a whole it's a whole family affair for the Howard. So it's wonderful. I'm surprised that Bryce isn't in there somewhere as a kid or something at this point. So. But, you know, I think we can now move into some of our favorite scenes of this film, but also talking about Ron Howard's direction of the film is also a good place to start with that, because what I like about it is that you really do get the sense of the claustrophobia and the crampedness that is being in an Apollo spacecraft, and you get that sense of wonder from the astronauts being able to look out that window and see the Earth. I thought it was really cool, even in 1995, to be able to show the explosion the way that they did, and that actually really holds up. I think that they used all practical effects there and not try to do some kind of CG weirdness with it, because it really holds up very well on this viewing as well.
And I believe, I might be mistaken, but I believe when Fred Hayes is filming and he's showing the external, that some of that is real footage, because he was really using his camera to show what it looks like. I might be mistaken, but I'm pretty sure that he's showing some of that real footage. Wow. And they do just a beautiful job of seeing all that together. It's hard to tell sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. But we're going to go ahead and start with you, Anna. Any particular scenes that you wanted to talk about or moments that we haven't addressed while talking about the ensemble?
I think for me, it's one of the big scenes that I still use today, and I quote, is when they talk about you have to fit a square peg in a round hole. For me, that moment in that scene, it's where they have their carbon monoxide is just climbing too high and they need to get it down lower. Otherwise, the men will not be able to breathe. They will not have any usable oxygen left. And so they're trying to figure out how to, you know, it's just another hurdle that they're trying to overcome. And it's a beautiful moment because they all get together and they're able to use what they have on the spacecraft and to make it work. And that scene always sticks out for some reason. It's not an overly dramatic scene. It's just people getting things together and working. But I think for me, the reason why it sticks out so much is because they've already been through so much. And it's like, we've already been through so much. How can one more thing that seems like it should be something we should be able to do, be the thing that is what really gets us. And so I think that's why that scene sticks out for me, in the way that they're able to just skim right over it and just figure it out immediately.
Well, and that's NASA, right? I mean, like, it's like, those are the types of problems that you would think it would take a rocket scientist to solve. And just using the materials, it's so funny, like, using the exact materials they would have on that spacecraft, because of course they've inventoried everything they put into space. It's just an incredible feat for sure. And it shows the ingenuity, it shows the teamwork, it shows so much about what helped develop the space program to begin with. Actually, going back, and right now I'm listening to an audiobook. I love my audiobooks. And I want to get the actual name correct on it, but it's a Douglas Brinkley book, and it's basically talking about America's Moonshot. In fact, I believe that's the title of it, America's Moonshot, John F. Kennedy and the Great Space Race. And even in that book, they talk so much about the development of NASA and how they're trying to find these scientists that not only want to be able to get into space, but also are good public servants and want to do this for the betterment of humankind, essentially. And so it's just really cool to see that ingenuity and that just intelligence all come together, particularly in a scene like that. So it's great. But Brandon, any particular scene you want to call out?
Yeah, you all were talking earlier, you know, there's a lot of moments in this movie that sort of deal with, you know, dreams, nightmares, you know, unfulfilled reality, all that, you know, Tom Hanks' little dream about, you know, what would have happened had he been able to step on the moon and all that. I love that whole dream sequence, because it kind of goes along with this sort of theme about, you know, not quite fulfilling your dreams, you know, disappointments, not fulfilling your destiny, and yet working hard under the circumstances. But I love that little human moment of him, you know, just sort of fantasizing about, you know, what could have been. But yeah, you were talking about it. It just kind of stunned me watching this here 25 years later, and the movie doesn't look all that dated. You know, we're dealing in the very early days of CGI, very early days of, you know, computer graphics being used in movies, and yet everything looks very, very, not necessarily up to date, but very much, you know, proper, and nothing looks creaky to me. And I think it's because of the way that Howard's direction, he really brilliantly converges, you know, documentary footage with, you know, new footage he made for the movie, and he seamlessly incorporates everything. So it all is a great, you know, sort of trick of the eye. You're not quite sure what was fact and, you know, what he made up just for the movie.
Absolutely. Absolutely agree with you. And Howard, I think, is the perfect director to take on a piece like this, because he doesn't overly dramatize it, but just brings that really subtle view of things to the film that, like you said at the beginning, Brandon, it really reads like almost like a documentary that you're watching unfold in front of you. And I think that's the perfect way to handle a historical event. And he just really knocks it out of the park with this, for sure.
Well, he brings the humanness to it. He brings the human side and what our human emotions and our human feelings. And I think that reads volumes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I have several scenes that I could mention, but I've really already hit on a lot of the ones. I think that the movie, if you're putting the movie in a box and saying, you know, give me one scene that kind of defines this film, to me, it's Hanks looking out that window at the moon, and because it really helps show even though this is a national tragedy or a national event that's unfolding across all of the country and also the world, it helps put it in perspective of that one man at that one moment, and just really, that scene gets me. So that's probably the one that I would call out. And I know I talked about it earlier, but I just love it. So that's where I'm at with that. But incredible to believe that it's 50 years later, and we just celebrated that anniversary Of course, it didn't get much fanfare because of the situation we're living through at the moment. But I just think it's kind of incredible to think back that so much of this was happening 50 years ago. Also, incredibly sad or disappointing, I guess, that within our lifetimes, for the three of us here, that nobody's gone to the moon and nobody's been able to. We aren't funding NASA. We've got now private companies that are trying to step in and do things like a mission to Mars and things like that. And they kind of show that in the film too, that even on Apollo 13, after Apollo 11 was the first men on the moon, the country's already kind of deciding that they're over it, right? And that is kind of a sad point of this film, and that, like, thinking about the fact that it's been so many years and we really don't have the type of space program that I think Jim Lovell would have wanted us to have by now. It's just, I guess that's kind of my bummer of the movie, moving into if there was anything else that didn't work in the movie for you. To me, this is almost a picture-perfect film. But Brandon, is there anything that you would go back and tweak in the film?
No, I really don't think so. But going off what you said, I was reading part of Roger Ebert's review, and he's sort of echoing what you're talking about. He's saying, the equipment that they used in 1970, looks like a tin can compared to the kind of technology that we have today. And yet, here, we have much better technology which can take us, and yet no one's bothering or even cares. And that's kind of echoed in the scene where Marilyn Lovell and everyone come to watch the newscast over at NASA, and they're barely getting any news coverage, and it's treated as kind of like a sideshow almost, and not, the kind of coverage it would have gotten, say even a year earlier. So it really is interesting how just over the last, few decades, priorities have changed, even more since 94 when the movie came, or 95 when the movie came out. So yeah, I can't really say that there's nothing that doesn't work in the movie, though. I think that it sets out to do exactly what it does.
Yeah, absolutely. Anna, anything for you?
I don't think so. I mean, I think all that I have to say, and it sounds cliche, but all that I have to say are good things. I think I prefer that it's not dramatized, and that it doesn't need all of that. It just needs to tell the tale of what it's meant to do and how it brings us together as humans and brings those poignant messages together that way. For me, everything works great. And I think one of the things that highlighted it for me this time when I watched the movie was that the way that they give that important information to you about what's happening without it hitting you over the head or seeming too educational or boring, they do a great job of explaining what's happening without it seeming trivial or just really hard to follow. So for me, there isn't really anything that I can think of.
Yeah, I'm with both of you. It's just one of those films that is easily one of the decade defining films, and just a great film overall. I really enjoy it thoroughly. So any final thoughts as we move through this? I know Anna just brought up the fact that Jim Lovell is with us still, which is great. Born in 1928, so that makes him just about 91, 92 years old at this point. Maybe he could beat John Glenn for eldest in space. What do you think? Can we send him up?
Possibly. I don't know. And that's another thing that's fun that we didn't tell. Ed Harris played John Glenn in The Right Stuff. So that's a fun bookend in this movie too.
Yeah. Now, Brandon, put you on the spot here. Right Stuff or Apollo 13, which one are you watching if you want to watch a space movie?
Oh, man. I I know we're talking about Apollo 13. I don't know. There's just something about the right stuff that really grabs my, that just, you know, grabs the imagination. I don't know. This Apollo 13 is so documentary and everything, but there's something magical about the right stuff. I don't know. It's just hard.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, right stuff. I came to it way too late. I finally watched the right stuff within the calendar year, within the last year. I had never seen it before. But it is pretty wonderful talking about those Mercury 7 astronauts. And so I guess you could watch the right stuff and then immediately follow it with Apollo 13, or maybe you could go into First Man in between there, which I have not seen yet. We have not watched First Man.
I enjoyed First Man. I know some people didn't, but I think they were expecting Apollo 13, and that's not what Damien Chazelle was trying to do. So yeah, I'd be interested to see what you have to say. I also think another great space movie, even though there's a lot of other themes going on in it, is Hidden Figures.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely. And the mainstay of that film, she recently just passed away.
Right.
At, I believe she was 101 or 102 years old, Katherine Johnson. So just some incredible people that helped bring us to the moon and bring us into space. Just, this is such a great film. And again, something that definitely you should go back and revisit if you haven't, because it is celebrating that 25th anniversary. And of course, Apollo 13 happened in April of 1970. And so that's why we're releasing this in April of 2020. So other than that, Anna, you had something?
Well, yeah, I think we'd be remiss to not talk about the incredible soundtrack in this film.
Oh, of course.
It is one of, I think, the best soundtracks. It's beautiful. So it's orchestrated by James Horner. And the way he does it, he has just a gorgeous build. And the way that he orchestrates that when they're doing the launch is a great example, and everybody's sitting waiting for the launch of Apollo 13, and the way that he builds the score and the momentum, and he also adds this beautiful chorus that he has through a synthesizer, much like he does in Titanic, but just the way that he adds that, to me, it adds that humanitarian aspect that the film brings to. It's a beautiful score, and the way that he has it adds just as such suspense when it needs to, and touches a beautiful, and it's a great one. I just love the score in this movie. It's probably one of my favorites.
Absolutely. I mean, this is probably a controversial statement, but I almost prefer James Horner's scores to even John Williams. And I know saying that as a geek is kind of, I'm putting myself out there, but just incredible score for sure, and really highlights the moments that need that just slight bit of added something to make them truly great. And just such a talented composer. Talk about someone that left us too soon, for sure.
Well, and Brandon, I think when you're watching this movie, you're the one that mentioned the fact that when they have pauses in the music, it's almost just as impactful as when they have the notes, because mm-hmm. there's a time when they just stop the music for this added suspense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a I think the major difference between like a John Williams score and a James Horner score is, you know, John Williams scores are so majestic and epic, whereas James Horner's have kind of a poignance to them. There's a little mm-hmm. hint of like sadness, like, you know, you think about the Titanic score or this score, there's kind of a, you know, wistfulness to them that make them probably a little more personal than a John Williams score.
Yeah, I agree.
So. I will say my favorite, and it might be one of his lesser known scores, but The Rocketeer has such a great, beautiful main theme to it. It's yep. so good. I was watching it this morning and just like falling in love with that music again. So thanks for bringing that up. I'm glad that we definitely needed to talk about that before we were done. So Brandon, why don't you tell us a little bit about what's coming up on Classics or anything that you got coming up?
Yeah, Eric and I just chatted a couple days ago about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. It's a movie that he kind of requested when he first joined the show with me last year, and it's one I've been wanting to get to, so a big fun conversation about a big fun movie. And then the next one we're going to talk about is going to be On the Waterfront, which is, I'm surprised, it's the first time. Well, no, it's not, because we've talked about The Godfather, but it's we're going to be talking about Marlon Brando in his prime compared to Marlon Brando in his chubbier days. But it's going to be a good conversation. I'm looking forward to it.
For sure, for sure. On Beyond the Mouse, I'm not exactly sure. We have a lot of things planned in the future. We were going to review Mulan. Of course, that didn't happen. So we're going to be reviewing that a little bit later than we thought. But we are in discussions of bringing on some guests and talking about things. I know that the Brett and Vanessa really want to talk to me about all the things I'm missing at Disneyland. And so they are they want to do a Disneyland episode where they can gang up on me and tell me how much it's awful that I haven't been there. But I think that'll be fun, and some really cool things coming up in the future for Beyond the Mouse, for sure. And of course, the network, I should have started this episode off with this, but we have a brand new member to the Front Row Network. We really would like to welcome to the world Camden Gechner. So congratulations to Jeremy and Sarah on the birth of your second son. Just a beautiful baby boy. Can't wait to meet him in person. And can't wait to hear his opinion on the film Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice. I think that would be a good first review to have little Camden on to talk about that film. So we'll have to book that sometime in the future, but just great stuff. Anna, anything you wanted to add? What do you have coming up? What podcast are you going to join?
Hold on, nothing, Greg. no, in all honesty, it's, I think for me, I'm a creative type, so I'm anxious to see what I can think of, but I just, for me, it's been really fun to talk about this film, because it's one of my top 10 favorite films of all time. Now, granted, I don't watch a lot of movies, I'll be honest, but this one just really sticks out for me because of the way it was done. And because of what it made for me for the rest of my life. So it's been really fun to talk about it and to be able to go in depth on it and to share that with you all.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you both for joining. And thank you to all of you for listening. Definitely continue to follow us on social media. You can find us on nprillinois.org. Of course, on Facebook, you can find us on Twitter at Front Row Reviews with a Z. I don't know if we ever ask this anymore, but if you're listening to this, please go out there and give us a review on iTunes or whatever podcast platform you're listening to. That just helps us grow our audience and be able to bring our episodes to more and more people. And just a quick note to just continue to stay safe, stay healthy, stay inside for this bit. I know that it's difficult for everybody, and everybody has their own personal things going on. And just know that we're all in this and that we really will get through all of this. And just enjoy some movies maybe while you're in your little break here or your quarantine, whatever you want to call it. Just continue to love the movies that we've already visited, maybe visit some new ones, just like we've been doing with Brandon. It's been such a treat to be able to go through. And now I think the next one, I think I'm up next to pick. And I believe I'm picking Chef by Jon Favreau, a 2014 film that he did that I absolutely fell in love with the first time I watched it. And Anna has not seen it yet, so I can't wait to watch that with you guys. But thank you so much again for listening. This has been the Front Row Network. And for the Front Row Network, I am Craig.
I'm Anna.
I'm Brandon.
And we will see you real soon in the Front Row.